This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
Welcome to another edition of Clusterfucked. I'm Roger King. As always, we get right to the heart of the podcast. No messing around, no wasting time. We're going to the heartland today, to the middle of America for today's guests. The state of Nebraska makes me think of Bruce Springsteen. From the town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 14 on my leg. Through the badlands of Wyoming. Our guest today is Jane Klebb, the founder of Bold Nebraska. It's an organization that pushes progressive ideas in rural Nebraska. And Jane got national attention when she led the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. That was the battle during Obama's administration where the climate activists were taking on big oil, and usually big oil wins in these battles, but not this time. President Obama rejected the XL phase of the pipeline that would have gone through Nebraska, which prompted Rolling Stone magazine to call Jane the Keystone Killer. Bold Nebraska is now part of Bold Alliance, and Jane's the founder and president of that organization. And I might be bearing the lead because she's also the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party. Jane Klebb, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, excited to be with you.
The Keystone Killer is in the house. All right. So I, as I said there in the opening, you've got a lot on the go, all in the name of liberal and progressive activism in Nebraska. And I want to dive into some of the stuff you're working on, and of course the Democratic Party things. But I was thinking on the way here, in a number of ways, you're kind of the ideal guest for this podcast because it's about liberal clustering. So I spend a lot of time talking about clustering, you know, in the literal sense where liberals choose to live in the U.S., but also in the figurative sense, where I kind of preach ad nauseum that we need to spend less time talking to people who already agree with us and more time talking or trying to persuade those who don't. And so you're, you know, right in the heart of it in red state America, pushing liberal and progressive ideas. So you're doing that part of it. But you also literally moved, which is something I advocate whenever possible, if liberals could actually move to red states and change things politically. I think you were from Florida and then you moved to Nebraska. I know it was for a relationship. But what else about Nebraska made you want to move there and you know, start doing all this activism work?
I think people assumed when I moved to Nebraska that we would have lived in one of the cities, because I was living in D.C. and had lived in Philly and Fort Lauderdale before I moved to Nebraska. So, you know, I had actually not even gone to any of the major cities in Nebraska, which are really Omaha and Lincoln, pretty much the first year I was in Nebraska. My husband's in the cattle business. And so my experience with Nebraska was always the rural parts, in particular the Sand Hills, which are this beautiful, intact grassland that has the Ogallala Aquifer essentially sitting at the surface in many areas, and it's filled with wildlife and obviously lots of ranching. And so that's what made me fall in love with Nebraska, was this beautiful landscape and the way that I saw ranchers like taking care of Mother Earth and raising, you know, livestock in a really humane way.
And those were the people you got to know when you led the fight against the pipeline. You got them on board, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I think when the Keystone fight first started, Nebraska really wasn't on the radar screen for the environmental leaders that were taking on the pipeline for a climate perspective, right? A lot of the green groups had just suffered a big, huge loss with the cap and trade bill that went down in flames. And they were all kind of doing the soul search about how do we get people engaged in the climate fight, because obviously just engaging people on the coast didn't work for them, right? They fought the cap and trade bill using an inside strategy, using people on the coast, and that failed because it didn't bring enough kind of unlikely alliance and coalition people to the table in order to get enough votes to pass.
Right.
So they started looking at unique fights, and the Keystone Pipeline was one of those. And Nebraska wasn't on their radar because they thought the ranchers in Montana would be more on their side, more open range. And so they hadn't even done any organizing in Nebraska. And I started getting phone calls from farmers and ranchers I knew because of my husband, asking if I had heard about this pipeline. And I certainly wasn't a climate activist at the time. And so I hadn't heard about it either. So it was this weird kind of right time, right place, right people coming together to kind of really take on that fight.
And there was, I think, sort of a turning point, because I was reading something about it. I believe it's he's a rancher, a farmer named Randy, who you kind of cleverly brought into the campaign as sort of a symbol of the whole thing. How did that go down exactly?
Yeah, so Randy Thompson, his family's land was in Merritt County, and his family, his mom and dad, saved their entire lives in order to have enough money to buy their own land. So in Nebraska, a lot of family farmers and ranchers have to rent land because it's just so expensive and they can't afford to purchase it outright. So Randy's family finally had enough money. They bought this land, and then several years later, you know, they get a door knock saying that the Keystone XL pipeline is going to take their land through eminent domain if his mom didn't sign right there on the spot today, no negotiating price. And so Randy obviously got really pissed off, and he was a conservative Republican, had never been involved in politics, certainly was never engaged in progressive or Democratic politics. But he knew about Bold because we were kind of out there at that point, kind of talking about the pipeline on the radio and doing rallies and protests. So he emailed me, and I emailed him back right away saying, look, we have a meeting come up. Why don't you come to the meeting? And what I saw happen with Randy is, first of all, he's tall and has a swagger about him, cowboy hat, like a typical rancher.
Right. The template of what we would think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody knew him. And I was like, oh, well, who's this guy? Because I didn't know what Randy looked like at the time. So I went up to Randy also and just started to introduce myself. He explained, he sent me this email. And we just really had, first of all, an instant connection. But I knew from an organizing perspective that he already had credibility with his peers and other landowners. And so we just started to ask Randy, you know, over the next several months to do more and more things. And then we created a whole campaign around him called Stand With Randy that really took off in our state.
Yeah, and that was sort of the turning point. But I guess the majority in the state eventually were on board with, on your side of the aisle, I would assume, on this issue.
You know, initially, because we did polling right off the bat, initially, so we only had 30% of Nebraskans with us that were against the pipeline initially, because TransCanada, like all these pipeline companies, was very clever. They started to run a ton of advertising talking about how this was going to get us off foreign oil and how this was American oil, which, of course, it's not. And, of course, it's not going to get us off foreign oil. So they were very clever. So we didn't have a ton of support initially. We had a lot of support of the landowners in the route and the tribal nations on the route, but the general public, we didn't. So it took a good 4 years of real everyday organizing to get the majority of Nebraskans on our side. And now we have almost 60% of Nebraskans on our side.
Fantastic. Great persuasion. Well, taking the overview, what do you think the biggest misconception in your mind is about Nebraska, and maybe we can just say rural communities, those voters, in terms of what motivates them politically in the state? Is there, you know, because there's sort of this perception that, progressives can't get any traction in those kinds of communities. Do you think people are, there's a misconception about that or something specific?
There's no question. So I think people's perception of rural is that it's white and racist. I'll just put it out there.
Fair enough.
I think people think that in rural communities, there's only white people and they are all a bunch of racists. And my experience is just total the opposite. I mean, yes, there's racism in rural America. There's racism in urban America. It is everywhere. And it's something we all obviously are now confronting in a very real way with the president who's in the White House.
Right.
In a lot of these small towns, you have a growing number of Latino and other immigrants who are moving to the small towns because they feel safe there. There's a strong sense of community with the churches and schools. There's jobs, whether it's in the fields or in the meatpacking industry. And so there's this very interesting thing happening in rural America that I don't think gets enough attention on. You know, some of our towns in Nebraska are now 50, 60% Latino. The town that I live in, Hastings, it's about 25,000 people. It's one of our bigger small towns. And, you know, we now are probably about 20% Latino. So there is a lot more diversity. And even beyond the diversity that's growing in our small towns, rural people are definitely have a very strong independent streak, a very, like, true populist streak where they know that the government has a role. They don't want big government, and they certainly don't want big corporations. And so they really believe in kind of like small town, helping each other, community, in really supporting the community infrastructure, especially our public schools and our hospitals. So there's just a lot of misconceptions about what rural people and small town folks want in our government. And it's very much in line with the Democratic Party.
Well, and that's really interesting about the changing demographics. And can we assume that, you know, the various communities are getting along, Latinos and the farmers and everybody else in some of these smaller places?
It's taking work. There's just no question about it. And, you know, I think in Fremont, one of our small towns where meatpacking industry is very large and getting bigger because Costco is developing all these, unfortunately, developing all these chicken barns and, you know, wanting to process a million birds a day. It's this really big fight that's happening right now in our state about our water quality and quality of life. And you start to see the Latino community kind of linking arms with a lot of the family farmers because of the bad working conditions in some of these, you know, meatpacking, and the family farmers feeling like they're also being taken advantage of by Costco in the way that they force farmers into these contracts where they essentially get into a cycle of debt. So you are starting to see a lot more relationship building. And in my own personal experience, that's also because our kids are going to school together. We see each other at soccer games and church and community events. But it's going to take work. And Grand Island, one of our towns where a lot of, you know, African immigrants were coming in, there was actually clashes between Latino and African immigrants, but there's a group kind of sprung up around that conflict and has worked really hard. And now you have a beautiful multicultural relationships happening in Grand Island. So it's going to take the white progressives linking arms with the communities of color that are coming into our small rural towns in order for it to work productively for everybody.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, even a couple of the other the races having a little conflict, not just, you know, the white versus ethnic. Which liberal or progressive ideas do you think can get the most traction in Nebraska, where you can find common ground, where Republican voters might consider voting for a Democrat based on certain issues? Obviously, we've just been talking about, you know, the environment and those sort of things. What else would be, you know, issues that might you know, get some crossover appeal, have crossover appeal?
Yeah, so there's a couple ones that resonate really strongly with people. The first one is the ending of the abuse of eminent domain for private gain. So obviously, you know, progressives support eminent domain for roads and kind of public uses, but it is now being abused by corporations, whether that's a pipeline taking land for their use using eminent domain, or a chicken, you know, a big chicken factory taking land for eminent domain, or in a lot of our urban communities, a big football stadium taking land through eminent domain.
Right.
So that is an issue that really bridges urban and rural. People see, you know, our government abusing their powers and handing it over to a big corporation. So that is a big issue that I wish more Democrats, especially our Democratic candidates for president, would run on and stake that ground, because Republicans have ceded that and are just right in line with kind of allowing corporations to take your land. The other one is really protecting our public institutions, whether that is the hospital or the public school in our communities, that because our towns are shrinking, are closing. And without expanded Medicaid and Medicare, our rural hospitals will literally not be able to keep their doors open, which will mean people will have to drive an hour or 2 hours just to get basic health care. So that is something also that definitely resonates. And then on public education, I mean, I think it's surprising for some people when I tell them Nebraska, you know, this big red state, we have 100% public power, so we have no private utilities. It's all owned by the public. And we do not allow charter schools in our state. So all of our schools are public schools. And that's something that the Republicans are actually trying to turn back the clock on. And so as Democrats, we've been very strong about protecting that. And public schools is another thing that really resonates with rural people.
Well, on the healthcare front, you know, we saw Obamacare eventually become, you know, majority popular. It took a while in the polling, but what about within Nebraska? I know maybe you would like to refer to it as the Affordable Care Act instead of Obamacare, but for the marketing. But is it relatively popular now?
So I actually worked for 2 years on getting Obamacare passed here in the state. Our target at the time was Senator Ben Nelson, who was a Democrat. I wasn't the party chair yet, and so we worked hard to show Senator Nelson that rural communities really supported Obamacare. And that was the thing I think that surprised both Senator Nelson as well as myself as an organizer the most, that our rural communities actually had more of a need for Obamacare than some of our more kind of wealthier parts of Omaha and Lincoln. Not to say Omaha and Lincoln don't have the need for it as well. But, you know, there was more private corporations there like Blue Cross Blue Shield and Mutual of Omaha that was providing insurance for a lot of workers versus in our small rural towns, there's a lot more small businesses and independent producers, farmers and ranchers. So we really showcased rural people, whether they were, you know, the priest in charge of the local church or just farmers and ranchers that needed Obamacare in order to stay alive or in order to not be living on the razor thin margin that family farmers already are and spending $20,000-$25,000 a year on health insurance to provide for their family because, you know, they were a small business. So that really turned the corner. And what I saw is kind of middle class and working class Nebraskans in rural Nebraska were talking about healthcare and the need for affordable insurance the same way that people were in kind of North Omaha, where a lot of our African Americans, or South Omaha, where our Latinos live. So those bridges we have to highlight and not let the Republican Party, which is what Trump is doing very well right now, is try to use urban and rural and create these pretend wedges and divides between us. Healthcare was the perfect bridge for that.
Well, and, you know, the Democrats obviously ran on it quite successfully in 2018 in the midterms. But it is frustrating, you know, for people in other parts of the country to see, you know, what appears to be Republicans in places like Nebraska voting against their own interests, because the Republicans certainly aren't offering anything. They're not even bringing anything to the table anymore on healthcare that I'm aware of. So it's like there's just no debate now about which party is offering, you know, something good for its people. So it's sort of frustrating, but it sounds like you're encouraged by, you know, the trajectory of the way, you know, the voters there are thinking.
Yeah, and I get that frustration. It's one of the most common things that some of my friends who live on the coast say to me as well. All of that sounds great, Jane, but they're still voting against their best interests. And I think there's a couple of things on this. And J.D. Shulton, who's running for Congress in Iowa, often says some of these similar things. Like, one, you don't know what their best interests are, right? So don't say that they're voting against their best interests when you're not even 100% sure what those best interests are. So we got to start there. Like, I think it's just, we need to stop saying that as progressives. Instead, we have to take the responsibility on our shoulders for completely ignoring and abandoning red state and rural communities. I can tell you that the red state parties, including Nebraska, barely get any resources from the national party committees. And so people are expecting us to kind of turn this historical vote tide around with zero money. And you can only do so much with kind of the duct tape that we're currently operating under. So that's number one. Like,
right,
if we want to turn things around, we got to put double the resources into the red and rural areas. So that's number one. Second, the Democrats literally have not shown up to rural communities to stand with them on any issue since the 1980s, when farmers were committing suicide and filing bankruptcies at record numbers because of the farm crisis. That was the last time that a farmer or a rancher or somebody in rural America will tell you that Democrats showed up and showed up on a regular basis and actually did voter outreach to them. So we have to start showing up in these communities again and making the case to them why Republicans have turned their back historically on the things that they deeply care about, whether it's healthcare, education, ag, and show what Democrats are actually going to do.
Well, and you know, I totally agree, which is one of the reasons I started this podcast. I want to get liberals thinking about you know, not leaving some of these communities behind and competing everywhere. You know, I spoke with the chair of the Democratic Party in Wyoming, and we talked about, you know, in terms of the population numbers too. I mean, there's so much money, you know, sort of pouring into Texas, like when Beto O'Rourke's, you know, ran his Senate campaign. And, you know, there you've got to move a million votes to, you know, beat the Republicans because the margin is so big. Whereas in smaller states, you know, we're not talking about a lot of votes that if you could change minds or get more people out, you could, you know, win more elections and with a little investment, as you said.
Speak the truth. You know, and it's just like, I try to tell this, so keep on doing what you're doing because, you know, yes, the chair of Wyoming, he's amazing. And all of us kind of little, small, red and rural states say the same thing to Chair Perez and all of our leaders all the time is that if you were to give us $1 million, you know, just a small slice of what was being dumped into Florida or Texas, you would have seen us win races. But we can't do it, you know, with just kind of unicorns, right? Like we actually need real resources here to win the election.
No, understood, of course. Just wanted to, because we've mentioned a couple of other states in the region. I know that Bold Nebraska now is part of Bold Alliance, which is, as it implies the name, the number of states now you've joined together. Which states besides Nebraska are involved and what key issues are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, so we are doing work in Virginia, West Virginia, South Dakota, in Oregon, and it's all around kind of property rights, water, and stopping these risky export pipelines. So that's both fracked gas as well as tar sands. We do a little bit of work in Minnesota, too, kind of helping landowners there and in Wisconsin. So we go into the states and we kind of go there for like 1 or 2 weeks and do intensive training with the landowners and the organizers that are on the ground. And then we help connect them with donors and other resources. And we've literally kind of opened up our library of documents that we've created over the last 10 years so they don't have to recreate the wheel of landowner organizing materials and models that we created here in Nebraska.
Great. It sounds like, you know, the work that needs to be done. I'm tipping my hat to you. Before I let you go, we got to talk 2020 for a second. Now, even folks who follow politics don't necessarily know all the minutia of the Electoral College, so I'll just state that Nebraska is unique, along with the state of Maine, the two states that they don't award all their electoral votes to the winner of the state. It's by congressional district. So Nebraska has 5 electoral votes, 2, you know, because they have 2 senators like every other state. And then, of course, you've got 3 congressional districts. And so a presidential candidate has to win each individual congressional district to get the electoral vote. Now, normally the Republican usually wins and gets all 5, but Mr. Obama in 2008 did win, I believe, the 2nd congressional district, which is Omaha, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so he got an electoral vote, and it's only 1 electoral vote, but we've seen some pretty close elections, so they all matter. Do you expect that, after we just finished saying they're not putting enough resources, and do you expect that they will take it seriously and in Nebraska and put a little money in, or at least whoever, I know we don't know who the candidate is yet, but he or she will compete for at least that district, or maybe there's even another district in play?
We are making the case really strongly for CD2. We have a competitive congressional race there. A Democrat or a Republican wins or loses that seat. It kind of goes back and forth between both parties with only 3 or 5,000 votes. That's usually the vote margin on either side. So it's in play for Congress, but it's also in play for the electoral vote. We are definitely making the case. We have a proposal in hand, actually, that we're bringing to Chair Perez and some of the presidential candidates at the end of August at the next DNC meeting. You know, we've really started to transform the way that we're organizing in our state. So when I became chair, out of 93 counties, we only had 40 county chairs, and we did not have a grassroots kind of concrete organizing program. And now we have 73 county chairs after 2 years of me being chair, and we have 600 block captains. It's a new program that we started where volunteers sign up and then we give them 50 voters in their neighborhood so they don't have to drive to a different community. They know their neighbors and they're responsible to turn those 50 voters out. And it's hugely successful. We know where we had strong block captains in 2018, you saw anywhere from an 11% to an 18% increase in voter participation, which is a huge margin. If you're a political junkie, normally you can spend lots of money and hope for a 2% increase.
Wow.
So we feel like we've proven, you know, that we can do the work, and we're hoping that then the investments will also follow.
Right. Look, here's the evidence. Give us the cash. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. help a girl out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, keep up the good work. It's great. By the way, Ben Sasse, the Republican senator, just announced he's running for re-election. Do you think there's a possibility he might be vulnerable? I know there's probably not a Democratic candidate yet, but any chance that's a sleeper pick race for 2020?
It is. People are very frustrated. So Ben Sasse is vulnerable in two areas. One, President Trump is now underwater in his favorability here in Nebraska, which I know is shocking, but it's true. Farmers are really angry with him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Sasse has pissed off the, you know, loyal Trump voters because he's always talking bad about Trump, even though he then votes all the time with Trump.
Yeah.
And he has made the moderates angry because he's not taking action against Trump's more kind of racist or misogynist kind of actions.
Right.
So it's very, Sasse is in a very interesting position. He obviously will have as much money as he wants because the Koch brothers firmly support him. He's always at the Koch conferences. He's one of their keynote speakers all the time. But we have three grassroots Democrats who've kind of put their hat into the race. And then there's some kind of former state senators and other elected officials who are currently looking at the race. So it could be, you know, it could definitely be a sleeper race, especially if we do get a lot of resources for the congressional district and a lot of electoral vote that could help pull somebody over.
Absolutely. No, and I know he's like the worst of both worlds. He's critical, but just in, you know, a few tweets here and there, but never stands behind anything in terms of taking on Trump. We'll do our best to encourage folks to throw a few bucks towards Nebraska, you know, when they're making their donations. You know, I mean, it's great that there's all these, you know, groups now that where you can donate from any state and pick the races that you want to support. So we'll keep an eye on it. Maybe we can check in with you again in 2020 and see what's happening down on the ground there.
I love it. And I have a book coming out actually in January 2020 called Harvest the Vote, How Democrats Can Win Back Rural America. So as it gets closer, maybe we can visit again and see what's cooking for the Iowa caucus.
Love it. Perfect. Absolutely. Love to talk to you about that. Thanks, Jane. I really appreciate your time, and you're doing great work. Hope everything goes well.
Keep the podcast going, man. It's exactly what we need.
Okay. Thanks a lot. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Well, that was fun. Going to the heart of Nebraska and talking to the Keystone Killer, Jane Klebb. If you want to follow Jane on Twitter, her address is at Jane Klebb. Now, she spells it K-L-E-E-B, so it sounds like it would be Klebe, but it's not. It's at Jane Klebb, and also at Bold Nebraska, and also at Nebraska Dems, because, of course, she is the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party. A lot on her plate, doing great work motivating those rural voters and organizing. And I hope that the DNC listens and puts some money into Nebraska and some of these other smaller states where, as we talk about in this podcast a lot, the margins aren't that huge. You can win some more elections by just changing a small number of voters. Speaking of Twitter, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, the handle is at CF the podcast. My moniker on there is the Civil Liberal, but the actual Twitter handle is at CF the podcast. And as we always say, check out more episodes at cfthepodcast.com. And there's an option to support the podcast there as well. As I always say, we don't have a big investor or advertiser behind us. This is a labor of love, but we do have some expenses. We record at dbaudio.ca, a lovely recording studio, and we have website design and hosting and other expenses. So there's a thing to click on there, support the podcast. If you want to give us a few bucks, we appreciate it. And also, love people to join the mailing list. That's the best way to get notifications of future episodes and anything else we might be doing at CF headquarters. It's free, just, you know, takes 2 seconds to sign up, and nothing else is going to show up in your inbox, only official correspondence from CF headquarters. The podcast is available on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and many of the other platforms, but we love it when you actually visit the website, cfthepodcast.com, sign up for the mailing list, and then we can keep in touch that way. Thanks again for taking the time to listen.
The Clusterfuck Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
I'm Roger King. That'll be all.